Conference number 7, 10:45 a.m., September 24, 1985. Father Hugo.
The prayer. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Father, you open your kingdom of heaven to those born again of water and the Spirit. Increase your gift of love within us. And may all who have shared, been raised to share your life in baptism, persevere in grace and grow in love in order to receive all that you have promised. This we ask through Christ the Lord. I gave you a yellow sheet there. You can take it. That's sort of nothing, adds nothing to what was said. It confirms it. That's the teaching of the Vatican Council on this. One of the chapters of the Constitution of the Church is the universal vocation of holiness. We are all called to holiness. This has been a grave misunderstanding in the Catholic body for centuries, that only religious are called to holiness, and that lay people can settle for a second-rate kind of Christianity. There is only one kind of Christianity. There is no second-rate kind. And this has been an error and a misunderstanding. Not to believe that we are to seek after holiness is a kind of heresy, St. Francis de Sales says. We are all the baptized. Baptism itself is what introduces us into this life of holiness and the duty to seek after holiness, even to seek after the highest perfection of holiness all. We can grow in it. Now, we don't have to find it all at once. You can't make up your mind today to be holy and be a saint tomorrow. It's a growth. But we always must live the Christian life, as we spoke of responding to grace, in order that we may grow. This growth becomes a duty, like parents will try to get their children the proper nutrition and exercise so that they will grow physically and mentally too. And so we must grow spiritually. That love of God with your whole heart, with your whole soul, if you stiffen all your muscles and make the resolution to do it tomorrow, you can't do it. We must grow into that. It's the result of daily experience and the daily living of the Christian life. There are a number of degrees, there are an infinite number of degrees of holiness, from the basic one to the top one. The basic one is to love nothing more than God, nothing as much as God, and nothing contrary to God. God is first in our lives, and then we grow by little steps of love every day. We'll see how. Saint Jesus himself tells us the steps of love in his gospel when he says, I was hungry and you gave me to eat, and I was thirsty and you gave me to drink. I was sick and in prison and you visited me. I say to you, he who does it to my least brethren does it also to me. Do you see how definitely Jesus identifies the love of neighbor with the love of God? He who does it to the least of my brethren does it also to me. And St. Augustine points out that we can consider these the little steps of love, these works of mercy. This is how we can grow daily in love, by carrying these out. Our great duty is to love God. But the only way we see God in this world is in our neighbor, all our neighbors, even our enemies. Otherwise, we see him only, know him only in faith. And so, it's a double growth in the growth of love of God and the love of neighbor. And they work together. In ethics, if you studied ethics in college, they distinguish between social ethics and personal ethics. The great teaching of Jesus is that all ethics, all moral teaching is suspended from, hangs from, the love of God, from love. There is no difference in the love which we owe our neighbor and the love which we owe God. It is one love, the love of charity. And this is to be our basic duty of Christian. So you can read that text in St. Matthew chapter 25. I was hungry and you gave me to eat. One of those ones we take for granted. We'll come back to it. But these are the steps of love, and it should be a daily growth in love. Another text you can read on love is St. Paul's letter to the Corinthians, his praise of love and his paean of love in the letter of St. Paul to the Corinthians, chapter 13, wherever he speaks of love there. And it's a beautiful, it's a passage that we don't often. I came across the other week a little book by an Oriental who has a meditation on this paean of love. I've never seen one written by a Christian. It takes an Oriental to discover it for us. I'm sure there are many Christians have a lot of it, but we don't pay enough attention to it. If you want to read it, it's chapter 13 of the first letter to the Corinthians. And it immediately follows another chapter which speaks of what St. Paul considers lesser gifts of God. He was in Corinth. They had what we would nowadays call a Pentecostal or a charismatic movement. They had many gifts there, and people received these gifts. And they wrote to Paul about them, and Paul wrote to them. And you'll find his answer to them on the value of these gifts, in the charismatic gifts, in his chapter 12 of the first letter to the Corinthians. He acknowledges them as gifts of God, but he does not accept them as the greatest gift of God. They are gifts of God, like the gift of tongues, the gift of healing. These are gifts of God, but they're not the greatest gifts of God. And so he comes to the end of that chapter, and now, he says, the first verse of the letter of 13, now I will show you the way which surpasses all others. Now I will show you the way that surpasses all others. He enumerates these other gifts, like the gift of tongues there. Suppose I had the gift of tongues. What good would it do you if I spoke to you in tongues? I don't even desire a gift of tongues. I desire a gift of the tongue that I can talk to you with, because I want to exercise charity towards my brother and sister Christians. And I can do that if I'm comprehensible. I can do it best if I'm comprehensible. An incomprehensible language would not do me any good or you any good. It may be an unusual experience, but what good is it? And that's exactly the line of argument that St. Paul takes in this. These gifts, they're sort of a fireworks. They do make the pagans think of God, but they don't make the pagans believe in God, and they don't make the pagan love God, and therefore they're a secondary, an inferior gift. And now I will tell you a way which surpasses all the others. And then he goes into his praise of love. If I speak with human tongues and angelic as well, but do not have love, I am a noisy gong and a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and all knowledge and comprehend all mysteries, if I have faith great enough to move mountains and have not love, I am nothing. If I give everything I have to feed the poor, and I hand over my body to be burned, and I have not love, I gain nothing. Without love, anything else we do is simply useless in the sight of God. We can't even call it martyrdom if it's not done out of love. And this is why the church will examine even one who dies for the cause, to see if it's really for the cause. For example, Charles de Foucault was one of the great saints of modern times in the 20th century. He will probably never be canonized as a saint. He was a Frenchman, and during the First World War, he was a hermit. He abandoned everything. He lived a hermit's life in the desert, but he allowed his cell to be used as an armory by the French government. That mars his witness. He will never be canonized a saint. I'm sure of that. Because the question will be, was he acting as he did for political reasons or for religious reasons? Was it out of love? Was it out of love for country? And the French are very strong in their love for country, as we are. Or was it for love of God? So, this is to be taken literally. If I give my body to be burned, he was murdered by the very people he was instructing. But he will never be considered a martyr. And if I give my hand all my possessions to the poor, a great philanthropist that handles millions will never be canonized. Because there is no love. So the greatest of all gifts is love. And this is the gift that is given to us at the center of our Christian lives for us to advance in to the very perfection thereof. That we can truly love God with our whole heart and our whole soul. It's a gift that is excludes no one. Everyone can have. And everyone can grow in this love. This is the summit of the Christian life. We come here really to the summit. This is the summit that beckons us on from the distance. It should be the goal of our whole lives, to grow in holiness, and that's the same as growing in love. Now, I wish to say a word about the two ways of seeking out love. In the course of time, there have been two ways that were accepted within the church as ways of seeking love. We could call them the way of lay holiness and the way of religious holiness. This is a problem that originates or it comes up even every Catholic family when boys and girls grow up and they begin to think about a vocation and what they'll do, and they're invited to become priests or religious by their teachers. And so this is a problem that parents have and young people have to settle a vocation. Of course, as I say, the lay people have had a misapprehension, which has been encouraged, at least by some of the clergy down through the years, that only the religious people that go into the monasteries or convents are called to holiness. That is false and wrong and contrary to the teaching of the Catholic Church. That's what that little yellow sheet has with it. But all are called to holiness. We finally have it stated by a general council for the first time. It's been stated by popes. It's been stated by saints. I gave you the argument of St. Thomas Aquinas. He didn't have to wait for the Second Vatican Council to learn it. They learned it from him. He lived in the 13th century. And that all, lay and religious alike, are called to this vocation of holiness. And we're all obligated to follow it. So, but these two kinds of life have arisen in the church. The way of lay holiness and the way of religious holiness. Now, the difference between lay holiness and religious holiness is not in the goal, but in the means to achieve that goal. If a man dies in New York and he leaves a bequest to relatives on the condition that they come to New York to live, You see? Then they can go there and get their fortune. They can go any way they want. He doesn't specify the means. They can come by airplane, they can go by train, they can go by car, they can walk if they so choose. He specifies the end. You must come to New York to collect the money. But the means, he leaves up to them. Any suitable means will do. And this is what God does. He sets the goal. Love God with your whole heart and your whole soul and your whole mind. This is the goal and this is the basic obligation. He gives certain means as counsels. But a counsel means they don't fall on us with complete obligation like a commandment does. But the idea of perfection, the duty to perfection, is a commandment. It's a precept. It is not a counsel. Here's where the misunderstanding has arisen. There are certain counsels. In fact, in the gospel, there are a million counsels. Not just three. A religious will distinguish three counsels. But there are many counsels. Why does people read the Bible every day? What point is there in reading the Bible? We can't find any new commandments every day. But there are many counsels there. We go there for counsel, for inspiration, for help in becoming holy. The one goal for all of us. So there, you might say, a myriad counsels in the Scriptures, but one great commandment that dominates them all, the commandment of love. And then a basic decalogue at the bottom, that's the floor. What we call the Ten Commandments, that's the floor. That's the first degree. To love nothing more than God, nothing as much as God, nothing contrary to God. That's what it is. If I injure my neighbor, how can I say that I love my neighbor? And if I don't love my neighbor, how can I say that I love God? If I disturb the domestic happiness of my neighbor by aspiring to his wife or she to a husband, how can we say that we love our neighbor when we're disturbing their peace and their happiness? You see, these Ten Commandments of the Decalogue set the absolute minimum of conduct beneath which we can go. We had the idea today with a new morality we could commit adultery and fornication and still say we love God, but we cannot. They all hang together, these laws. Love is the fulfillment of the law, St. Paul says. You'll find that text there on the page there in Romans. Love is the fulfillment of the law. The love of God doesn't contradict these Ten Commandments. It carries them out and goes beyond them. We can consider them the basis thing, beneath which we cannot go and say that we love God or love our neighbor. The minimum degree of love, the highest degree of love, love God with your whole heart and your whole soul and your whole mind. Now, then there are these counsels. Of the myriad counsels, which I say there are, which we, every time we read, if you're not interested in the counsels, and people will dismiss them sometimes, oh, that's only a counsel, I don't bother. Well, then if you don't believe in the counsels, don't bother reading the Scriptures. There's no point in it. Because that's why we read the Scriptures, to learn how to love God. They're not all obligatory, but they give us wise counsel. Just like if you want a job, or you want to do your job well, you go and you seek counsel, or you take a course in a nearby college. And that you don't have to do that, but if you want to be efficient in your job, if you want to be grow in your professional knowledge and skill, then you do that. It will mean greater rewards for you and greater satisfaction for you. But you don't have to. So these counsels are better ways of doing it. Better ways of loving God. Better ways of growing in holiness. And that's why we read the Scriptures. Because somehow or other they address each one of us. We can find something there for our inspiration and help. And by looking at them and studying them, we discover them there. Well, but of these counsels, three have taken the preeminence in the history of Christianity. Poverty, chastity, and obedience. And these are the ones which are usually adopted by religious. They may take one or the other, But usually those three go together, or commonly they go together, poverty, chastity, and obedience. They are not obligatory, you see. But the point about the councils is, while the councils are not obligatory, the commandment is obligatory. The commandment is the commandment of perfection. So it's not right to say that perfection is a counsel. It is a commandment. It is the first and greatest commandment. But we don't have to take a vow of poverty in order to achieve perfection. We can use any suitable means. Any suitable means to seek after perfection. I'd like to read it to you in the way in which it's stated, not in the council, but by Pope Pius XI in our time. He's talking about husband and wife. Now, that puts a definite case. They are to seek holiness together. Points out that marriage is a partnership in holiness. The outward expression of love in the home demands not only mutual help, but must go further, said Pius XI. It must have as its primary purpose that man and wife help each other day by day in forming and perfecting themselves in the interior life. This is what husbands and wives ought to do. Like religious, supporting one another in an interior life. So married man and woman are to support one another in living an interior life. So that, through their partnership in life, they may advance ever more and more in virtue. And above all, that they may grow in the true love of God and the love of their neighbor, on which indeed depends the whole law and the prophets. The whole law and the prophets fall on this double law. For all men of every condition, in whatever honorable walk of life they may be, can and ought to imitate that most perfect example of holiness placed before man by God, namely Jesus Christ our Lord, and by God's grace to arrive at the summit of perfection, as is proved to us by so many of the saints. The summit of perfection, that's our aim, the aim of everyone. We are all like mountain climbers. We're all aiming for that one summit. And that summit is pictured for you concretely on the reverse side of one of these conferences here. I think it's the reverse side of Conference 5. Yes, you'll find the summit there as it was pictured by St. John of the Cross. And it's for everyone. So we're all called upon. Now, you'll notice that Pope Pius said about the means. He said, any honorable walk of life. Is a suitable means for seeking after perfection. Any honorable walk of life. There are some walks of life that are not honorable. As I notice as a pastor, whenever I have a gangster in my parish, is that an honorable walk of life, even though he wants to buy an organ for the church? Can I honor him as a true Catholic? Sometimes they are. Or numbers man, you see, those are not honorable walks of life. The prostitution. But they're Catholic prostitutes, and they go to church sometimes, I guess. But it's not an honorable walk of life. It's not a suitable means of way of perfection. So we have to discover, you see, if our business is honorable, if it's honest, then it's a suitable means for seeking after perfection, even being very humble. St. Joseph was a carpenter, and that was a humble, honorable, but humble, but it's a suitable means of seeking after perfection. And so there are any suitable means are sufficient. So we have then the way of lay sanctity and the way of religious sanctity. Ida Kudenhove, a Belgian woman, wrote a book called The Cloister and the Hearth. And this was written before the Vatican Council, and she knew all about this, and she wrote that book on it. And she compared the church to a church building with two towers. And she called the one tower the tower of lay sanctity, and the other one the tower of religious sanctity. And she said, you see, the tower of the lay sanctity she put first, and rightly, because Jesus was not talking to Carmelites when he said, be perfect. He wasn't talking to Carthusians or Benedictines or Franciscans or Jesuits or even Sisters of the Holy Family. They were far distant down the years. He was talking to lay people, ordinary people, men and women, peasants, fishermen, merchants, hangers-on. The only scholars there were the scribes and Pharisees, and they usually stood aloof from him. The scholars. Translate scribes, scholars, the intellectuals. They wouldn't listen. So this doctrine was taught to them. So the lay sanctity was first. That's what Ida Kuno said. The tower of the lay sanctity was first. It grew up in the early Christian ages of Christianity. You know that St. Augustine, who is still one of the great spiritual writers in our tradition, to whom people go for spiritual counsel and advice, St. Augustine, he lived in a world in the 4th century there were still no monasteries or convents around. He preached perfection to his people, to the lay people, in his cathedral at Hippo. And some of the greatest counsels on Christian perfection were given in those sermons. They're still treasured. They all had that consciousness, that awareness. So, says Ida Kuttenhove, the tower of lay sanctity, the builders built with great enthusiasm for a long time. Then the religious orders came on the scene, St. Benedict first. Only in the 6th century did St. Benedict come on the scene. And then much of the zeal went to the other tower, the tower of the religious holiness. And all the zealous people went into religion. And the lay people then lapsed again. And of course, this was during the dark ages of barbarism. The lay people, our ancestors, were living in the woods, you know, eating berries over in Europe. And so it took a long time before they were educated and could realize their duty. Then, of course, says Ida Kuttenhove, there were times in history that there were revivals, like the 13th century was a great revival in piety in the church, among the laity as well. But the great revival in the laity was in the 17th century with the inspiration especially of St. Francis de Sales. He's the first great general spiritual writer that did not write for the religious, didn't write for monks or nuns. He wrote for lay people. That's a book you should have. His Introduction to the Devout Life, in which he points out that all are called to holiness, and he calls it a heresy to deny that. Although many Catholics do deny it or have denied it, and even clergy, too. So that was the first handbook, you might say, that was written for lay people. Most of the handbooks were written for monks and nuns. And, of course, a lay person is not expected to live like a monk or a nun, although the basic values are the same, that love is the same for all. There's not two different kinds of love, one for the laity and one for religious. There's just one kind. So then we've had a revival in other revivals. There was a revival before the Vatican Council. Whenever I was a youth, there was a great revival in the church and a revival of piety. I learned about this duty of Christian perfection not from a priest. I never heard it once in my 6 years of the seminary. Not once. I learned it from a layman, Jacques Maritain, who, with his wife Raiza, came into the church in the 1920s. And I happened by chance to pick up a little book down in a bookstore in Pittsburgh. A couple of books. That was my introduction to this great Catholic writer who had just come into the church and devoted his gifts to the church. It was a little book called Prayer and Intelligence. And there I learned what I quoted to you verbatim this morning about perfection. I've never forgotten it. I never heard it. I went back to the seminary. I never heard another word about it. I never heard about it again until after I made a retreat, basically the same retreat that I'm offering you, and I was then a priest for 2 years. So generally and universally was it forgotten. So I have a great debt of affection to Jacques Maritain. I learned it from a layperson. And he and his wife lived it. They were a wonderful example of a husband and wife that did live it together. Raiza became a true mystic in her own right. Well, and then now there's another revival, we hope, with the Second Vatican Council. But this particular chapter in the Second Vatican Council, I think, is perhaps the greatest secret. There are two great secrets of the Second Vatican Council that people have not yet discovered, although they're written now for some time. The one is that the Church has condemned in advance the use of a nuclear bomb as a crime against humanity and against God. That has already been condemned by the Catholic Church. All we haven't done yet is get to go be completely consistent and say we shouldn't even have them around or build them, but that the warfare with them is condemned. Well, I don't want to get into that right now. But the other thing that's a great secret we're talking about, the Second Vatican, is this chapter right here, that all are called to holiness. And yet, I call it here, that's my title, I put that title on it, the spearhead of renewal, that's what it is. If there's going to be a renewal in the Church, all Catholics must learn this and know it and live up to it. This is the only way we can renew the Church. We can't renew the Church by painting the buildings or keeping them in good material shape. And that's what most of our zeal is spent on. We have to renew the Church by becoming saints. We are all called to be saints. There will be no renewal in the Church, no movement in the Church today of the various religious movements will bring about this renewal unless we are all convinced. Conviction, remember, faith is a conviction that we are to be saints and that we labor for this purpose constantly. So I won't go any further into talking about this because the Vatican Council there, if you read that, it points out everyone has this duty, from bishops down and from the sick and the laborers, everybody has this duty of seeking after perfection. And so now we can assume that we should be able to assume that there'll be more interest in that second tower, the tower of lay sanctity, which was really the first tower, since Jesus himself taught it to the lay people. And we will only become really Christians as we seek after this holiness. I'd like to say too that we have a great idea that goes wrong among us, that the good Christian life is a life of moderation. In medio stat virtus, in virtue stands in the middle. That was an axiom of ethics. That comes from Aristotle, not from Christ. Moderation has its value. It's a human value. But there is no such thing as moderation to be observed in the three great virtues of the Christian life. We should not be moderately faithful. We should not be moderately hopeful. Or we should not be moderately loving. We can grow in faith until great faith vanishes into vision. We grow indefinitely until we see God. We can grow in hope until hope grows into possession. There is no moderation in hope advisable. Hope becomes the possession of God and the enjoyment of God. There is no moderation. In love, we're told, we're given a very immoderate command with your whole heart and with your whole soul. Moderation in love can only mean one thing, mediocrity, lukewarmness. What moderation is proper for the there's the pagan virtues, prudence, justice, temperance. Temperance is a, let's just take that, temperance is a virtue which is in the moderate. We shouldn't eat too much and we shouldn't abstain altogether from eating. We shouldn't indulge in pleasure too much. We should not be insensitive and avoid all pleasure. That's what it means. But moderation itself is a great virtue. It's a great achievement. How many of us can eat moderately or drink moderately, especially the latter? Have you ever once seen anyone smoke moderately? Have you ever seen a cocktail party in which everyone or anyone was practicing moderation? It's not easy. And yet, it's not what a Christian is called upon to do, because we've seen that a Christian rules by not by reason, but by faith. And therefore, faith should penetrate even our moderation. I don't have it here. To be moderate in the face of God, said a Jewish sage, would be a profanation. We can't be moderate with God. The only measure with which we should love God, the only measure for loving God is to love Him without measure, said Saint Bernard of Clairvaux. The only measure for loving God is to love Him without measure. And concerning the counsels, like the counsels of charity, like of chastity, everyone is bound by chastity according to their state in life. The kind of chastity, the religious, was a complete abstention from marriage. It's not a giving up of sexuality simply, it's a giving up of marriage. We're not all called to that. But all are called to chastity. And lay chastity itself is very difficult. That means complete abstention before marriage, and I think that rule still stands before God. With all the psychologists and all the people that say otherwise, God has not changed His law. That's guarded by marriage, which is indissoluble, and therefore adultery is still sinful. Against that law, and we can't change it. And let's start with the counsel of poverty. We are not bound, lay people are not bound by the counsel of poverty. You don't have to make a renunciation of all your possessions and give them up as religious do. Of course, no one can make a complete renunciation of material things. Even a Gandhi had to have his silver watch and a pair of sandals and his shorts. You see, we can't make a complete renunciation. Everybody has to eat and drink and clothe themselves and have shelter, so it can only be a relative thing at best. But some go very far. A Dorothy Day or Peter Maurin, a St. Francis, in giving up the things of this world. But all are called by the spirit of poverty, whether lay or religious, to be poor in spirit. As Jesus says there, to be poor in spirit. This is for everyone. And Newman has this to say about lay people and the councils. He says, he speaks about Abraham, the prophet Abraham, who was a holy man, or the patriarch Abraham. He says this, Newman says, it is a greater thing, it requires a clearer and a steadier and a nobler faith to be surrounded with worldly goods, yet to be self-denying. To be poor in spirit in the world may be, and perhaps mostly is, more difficult than it is in a monastery. A monastery or a convent is intended to be just that, a protection against that kind of seduction. There's a wall between you and the world. There were, at least before television and radio. Now there are no walls. And the world can enter into the privacy of our homes. I've often said that I think the generation of my own parents, they were the last parents in the history of our civilization that could control the environment in which they raised their children. It's not possible anymore. The pressure is put on through radio and television, especially the latter. And the parents have lost control of their home environment. And so it is in monasteries. I've gone into monasteries where the recreation room has been retrained into an auditorium facing the television set. There's no recreation anymore, no games, no conversation. Everybody's facing the boob tube. And that's the recreation. And that's what religious now get for recreation. So the world has invaded and take the worldly values, take possession of it. But to get back to it, you see, it's difficult for the worldly, for the person living in the world, says Newman, to be surrounded with worldly goods, yet to be self-denying, to consider ourselves only stewards of God's bounty, and to be faithful in all things. That would be to define poverty for a lay person or a person living in the world, that we regard ourselves as stewards of all our possessions, and we are the dispensers of God's bounty. This is it. And then the chastity and obedience. Of course, lay people aren't required by a vow of obedience at all. And neither religious aren't, except they voluntarily take it. But we're all obliged to obey God's will, and we'll discuss that later, how we can discover God's will in obedience. So these are the counsels and the commandment. So the commandment is the goal, to love God with your whole heart. Now we'll move on to the next section. It will be in the same subject. It's just a different phase. We're traveling now towards that, as it were, towards that mountain of perfection. And we now go, the next section, the next conference is the rule of love. The rule of love. We don't want to leave love be a thing in the clouds. We want to bring it down to earth and inspire and transform our earthly lives. We want to live by the rule of love. What other rule is there to live by? There's the rule of reason. We have to abandon. We rise above it. I won't say abandon. Rise above the rule. We keep our reason intact. We keep our intelligence. But now we rise to faith, and it gives us new rules to follow. For example, faith tells us that not merely that we should be moderate in our food and drinking. We heard St. Paul say yesterday, I abandon all things and count them but as dung for the excellent knowledge of Jesus Christ our Lord. Faith would counsel us, urge us to give up earthly things, material things, as far as is possible. Like a St. Francis, like a Peter Marne. Peter Marne, I think, was the most detached man I ever saw or heard of in my life. He had nothing on, nothing, no possessions at all. He was like Gandhi, except he wore a suit, and that was all he possessed. And he took his coat off at night, and he put it under his head, and that was his pillow. And he slept in one of these hotels for the homeless. He had nothing else. So he lived in the 20th century. So there are still people that are inspired by this ideal and doing it. They think it's for them. They're not excluded from it. It's not just for people in monasteries. Sometimes people in monasteries are very relaxed about it. So, the love then is to be practiced and to become a rule in our lives. That's our purpose here. How can we make love a rule? Another rule that we follow is just the rule of law. Is it the law? Is it a sin? Is it a sin to do it? Catholics ask that. Is it a sin? Is it a sin? In other words, they'll follow the law. If you can prove it's a law, if I can show them the book and it's a law, then they'll obey that law. But to appeal to them by love, to act by love, you see, they don't do that. They haven't heard of that, perhaps. But this is what we want. We have to learn to live by love. And so we have to realize how to bring love into the activity of our daily lives. A Christian life is a life which is totally transformed by love.